Shalom, Hadavar students. Welcome to our next session in the first regathering, Zionism and the state, modern state of Israel. We're in session 18 right now, dealing with Israel present. So as is our custom, let's go ahead and review session 17. In session 17, we began in 1977 with the Likud coming to power, which was quite a switch from the labor-dominated government. President Anwar Sadat then made it known that he would like to come to Israel and discuss peace talks and the return of the Sinai. This was eagerly accepted by the Israelis, and before too long, Sadat made his 40-minute address before the Knesset. This generated the Camp David Accords, and then finally the Israel-Egypt peace treaty was signed. As we move to 1981, Iraq's nuclear reactor was destroyed by the Israeli Air Force in Operation Opera. It was quite an amazing operation. Step one, the aircraft took off from the Etzion Air Base. And then in an ironic twist, the aircraft flew over King Hussein's yacht. King Hussein is the king of Jordan. The third step was the 8 F-16 fighters striking the reactor. And finally, the last stage, the last step of Operation Opera, the aircraft returned at high altitude to land at the Etzion Air Base. And so it was a very complicated and very daring operation that was pulled off without a flaw. So, and the world criticized Israel for doing this. They criticized Israel publicly, but privately they said thanks for destroying Saddam Hussein's nuclear ambitions. Then Israel withdrew from the Sinai. The light blue is Israel proper. The darker blue is the occupied territories. And the red is the interim pullback from the Sinai in 1975, giving Egypt approximately one-third of the Sinai, returning approximately one-third of the territory. Then the redeployment in 1980, and now Egypt has been returned approximately two-thirds of the Sinai Peninsula. And now the redeployment in 1982, and Egypt now retained complete control of the Sinai once again. Then we looked at Operation Peace for Galilee as the IDF moved into southern Lebanon in order to try and smash the PLO harassment that came out of southern Lebanon, rockets and mortars and et cetera, all aimed at the northern Galilee settlements. And so Operation Peace for Galilee, which originally was going to be a 25-mile incursion into South Lebanon, eventually ended up going all the way to Beirut. And then Operation Big Pines was enacted. It was enacted to try and smash the PLO in Beirut once and for all, and it was unsuccessful. And so Lebanon after the war was quite a mess. It's a weak country. And as you can see from the map, Syria dominated northern Lebanon. Christian groups in two areas of Lebanon, Israel dominating southern Lebanon, and the United Nations down toward the border, supposedly there to protect Israel from Arab guerrillas and Arab terrorists. Hezbollah was then formed. In 1987, Hamas was founded, and the Intifada began as Arab youth, very fed up with all that was going on, tried to rise up and rebel against Israel. With the fall of the Soviet Union and there was a mass immigration of Soviet Jews into Israel, and that immigrant count was quite amazing. In 1989, it was 12,932 Russian Jewish immigrants, but in 1990, 185,227. And then it peaked in 1991 with 147,839. And then the immigrant count dropped off to 65,000 in 1992. Well, that brings us to our new material. And it's 1991, and Iraq attacks Israel with ground-to-ground missiles during the Gulf War. In August 1990, Iraq invaded and annexed Kuwait. It had long claimed ownership of Kuwait, of that territory, and the UN Security Council called for Iraq to withdraw and subsequently embargoed most trade with Iraq. On January 17, 1991, a U.S.-led coalition that included Britain, Egypt, France, Saudi Arabia, and other nations began a massive air war to destroy Iraq's forces and military and civil infrastructure. Iraq called for terrorist attacks against the coalition and launched missiles at Israel in an unsuccessful attempt to widen the war and break up the coalition. Now, this is a map summarizing Israel, the aerial threat, and the Gulf War from Martin Gilbert's Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. I will just read this summary if we find in the box. Here's the summary. Israel's small size, her proximity to Arab states that since 1948 have refused to make their peace with her, made her particularly vulnerable to air and missile attack. During the Gulf War, January through February of 1991, Iraqi missiles fell on Tel Aviv, Ramat Gan, and Haifa. Urged to do so by the Western nations, Israel refrained from retaliation, even in self-defense. In all, 30 Scud missiles hit Israel. Some were destroyed in the air by American-manned Patriot anti-missile missiles located near Tel Aviv, and several missile sites in Iraq were destroyed on the ground by British commandos. 4,000 Israeli apartments were totally destroyed, but only one civilian, the 51-year-old Eitan Grunland, was killed when a missile hit his home in Ramat Aviv on the 25th of January, 1991. So that's a summary of the Gulf War and Israel's involvement in the Gulf War. Now, under American and Soviet auspices, the Middle East Peace Conference convenes in Madrid. So the Gulf War and the political collapse of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics remolded the fundamental shape of politics in the Middle East. The modification in the political foundation of the region led to a reassessment by the Arab world of its relationship toward the State of Israel. The Arab nations re-examined Israel's offer to enter into mutual peace negotiations and chose to collaborate with Israel in building a fresh future for the region. In October 1991, a meeting under Soviet and American auspices was assembled in Madrid, Spain, for the purpose of beginning direct face-to-face negotiations. The Madrid conference called together the appropriate nations for an opening interchange. The purpose was to inaugurate discussions regarding two independent but related topics. Number one, there were two-party discussions, and number two, there would be collective discussions. The conference was simply an opening forum for all the participants. The Madrid conference had no power to force solutions or to prohibit agreements of any sort. The two-party talks were geared to the resolution of conflicts in the past, and the collective talks were aimed at developing the region for the future. Now, as a result of the Madrid conference, direct discussions between Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and the Palestinians began on November 3, 1991. And these talks boiled down to four independent sets of two-party negotiations. So here's a summary of the two-party talks. The purpose of the bilateral negotiations, the two-party talks, is to resolve the conflicts of the past. The goal of the talks with the Arab states is to conclude bilateral peace treaties, and the talks with the Palestinians are aimed at achieving a settlement in two stages over 5 years. And so here's a chart of the two-party talks. The talks between Israel and Lebanon did not yield a peace treaty. There's no peace treaty even today. The talks between Israel and Syria did not result in a peace treaty. The talks between Israel and Jordan did result in a peace treaty on October 26, 1994. The talks with the Palestinians in Israel did result in a transitional self-government that was supposed to be in existence for 5 years, and then permanent self-government arrangements would be discussed. So that's a summary of the two-party talks. Now, the collective talks. The purpose of the multilateral talks is to build the Middle East for the future. Issues of regional concern are discussed in a forum that fosters cooperation and builds confidence between the parties. And there are five work groups were designated, a work group about water, one about environment, one for arms and security, another discussing economics, and finally, a discussion of the refugees. All right, let's move to 1992. Diplomatic relations are established with China and India. Israel establishes these diplomatic relations. And a new government headed by Yitzhak Rabin of the Labor Party is brought into office. The Labor Party of Yitzhak Rabin won a clear victory in elections held June 23, 1992. Rabin called for peace and reconciliation with Israel's Arab neighbors. Now, this would be a good time, if you have not viewed it, it would be a good time to view Israel, A Nation is Born, Part 5, dealing with the years 1973 to 1991, by Abba Iban, Israel's former foreign minister. This would be a good time to review or to watch that video. All right, let's move to 1993. Israel and the PLO sign a Declaration of Principles on interim self-government arrangements for the Palestinians. Ongoing peace talks produced historic agreements between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization in September of 1993. It's often called the Oslo Accords. The PLO recognized Israel's right to exist, and Israel recognized the PLO as the representative of the Palestinians. The two sides then signed on September 13 an agreement for limited Palestinian self-rule in Gaza and the West Bank, beginning with the city of Jericho. Here's a picture of Rabin and Arafat shaking hands, signing the agreement under the auspices of President Clinton in the center there. So the agreement was known as the Israeli-Palestinian Declaration of Principles, the DOP. And it was to be implemented in two stages. Again, stage one, interim self-government arrangements, and stage two, permanent status arrangements. The next day, Israel and Jordan signed a framework intended to pave the way for a future peace treaty. That agreement, known as the Common Agenda, includes the following components: security, water, refugees, displaced persons, borders, and territorial matters. In addition, the parties agreed to explore the potential for future cooperation on regional issues such as economy, tourism, natural resources, and human resources. Since the Madrid conference, talks between Israel and Syria have been carried out, and Israel has stated that she's willing to consider an element of withdrawal on the Golan Heights in the context of a peace settlement. But Prime Minister Rabin has stated that should a peace treaty that includes a significant withdrawal from the Golan Heights be negotiated with Syria, the proposed treaty will be put to a national referendum, a national vote, before it is signed. And unfortunately, there's been no progress between Israel and Syria right up to the present day. All right, let's move on to 1994 and the Gaza-Jericho Agreement. Shortly after signing the DOP, negotiations commenced in Cairo and in Paris between Israeli and PLO delegations on the implementation of the first stage of the interim agreement. The negotiations were completed after 7 months of discussions. The Gaza-Jericho Agreement was signed in Cairo on May 4, 1994. It applies to the Gaza Strip and to a defined area of about 65 square kilometers, including Jericho and its suburbs. So the Gaza-Jericho Agreement included the Gaza Strip along the coast of Israel there. And on this particular map, the gray areas are areas of Israeli settlement in 1994. And the other part of the agreement dealt with the area around the city of Jericho in the Jordan Valley. They're right near the Jordan River, the city of Jericho. Israel is responsible for external security, while the Palestinians are responsible for public order and internal security. So here's a summary of the Gaza-Jericho Agreement. It consisted of the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and Jericho and the transfer of powers and responsibilities to a Palestinian authority. The agreement includes security arrangements, transfer of civil affairs, a legal framework, and an economic framework. Then came the Israel-Jordan peace treaty. King Hussein of Jordan and Prime Minister Rabin declared an end to the state of war between the two states in Washington on July 25, 1994. A formal Israel-Jordan peace treaty was signed on October 26, 1994. And here's King Hussein on the left signing his portion of the agreement, President Clinton in the middle, and then Prime Minister Rabin on the right. Rabin, of course, of Israel. On the 29th of August, the agreement on preparatory transfer of powers in the West Bank was implemented. And here is a summary of this agreement on preparatory transfer of powers. The agreement dealt with the early transfer of powers and responsibilities in specified spheres in those parts of the territories not included in the Gaza-Jericho Agreement. The areas included were education and culture, health, social welfare, direct taxation, tourism, and other spheres as agreed. All right, 1994, the next year. First thing on the agenda is the Nobel Peace Prize. Amid caustic criticism, the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and PLO leader Yasser Arafat. And here's a picture of the three men receiving their Nobel Peace Prize. I don't think anybody argued with a peace prize for Peres and Rabin. I think the caustic criticism centered around, if I remember right, centered around Yasser Arafat, who was one of the most brutal and ruthless of terrorists leading the PLO. But anyway, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to him. Now we come to 1995 and Hamas and the peace process. Now the path toward peace has been painful for Arab and Israeli alike. The main problem has been terrorist attacks perpetrated mainly by the Islamic fundamentalist groups such as Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah. Hamas was created in 1987 as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, an Egyptian-born movement that rejects Western evils and calls for a pan-Islamic religious state. And of course, this is the logo of Hamas. We've seen this before. The word Hamas means zeal in Arabic, and it's an Arabic acronym for the Islamic Resistance Movement. Theologically, they believe that Islam must rule in the Holy Land and that divine salvation awaits those that destroy Israel. The most disturbing element in this terrorism is the fact that Hamas is recruiting teenage boys to strap explosives to themselves and become human bombs. Now here's a picture of a Hamas suicide bomber recruit. He's a little older than teenage, it looks like, but he was willing to strap bombs to his body and go and kill Israelis while committing suicide. Hamas terrorism is designed to disrupt the peace process begun between the PLO and Israel. Well, the peace process continued to crawl along toward implementation in spite of numerous terrorist attacks. By February 1995, 17 months after Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands on the White House lawn, 116 Israelis had been killed and 400 wounded in terrorist attacks. The major attacks included a couple of examples such as these. There's many more than these, but here's just two examples. December 5, 1993, a resident of a refugee camp in Gaza opens fire on a bus driving on the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway, killing one Israeli before being shot to death, and Islamic Jihad claims responsibility. Afula, April 6, 1994. A 19-year-old bomber of Hamas blows up a bus with a car bomb in this northern Israeli town. 9 people are killed, more than 50 others are wounded. And like I said, there's many more examples that I could share with you, but that's enough. Now, unfortunately, Arab fundamentalists are not the only ones perpetrating terrorist attacks. That's very unfortunate. But on the good side of the coin, the Jewish attacks are relatively few. The most famous is the Purim morning attack in Kiryat Arba by Dr. Baruch Goldstein. And here's Dr. Goldstein. On February 25, 1994, Goldstein, dressed in his reserve army uniform, entered the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron, that's the Cave of Machpelah, at 5:30 in the morning and fired 111 bullets from his Galil assault rifle into the Muslim worshippers before being beaten to death. And here is the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron. This is where he went. and this is the interior of the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron, and this is the area where 29 died and scores were injured. 1 year later, an article in the Jerusalem Report states that, quote, with the threat of brutal violence ever present, the army has tried to divide Hebron into Jewish and Arab zones, but the separation is a farce, and the hatred is pure and transparent. Now, Goldstein was a member of Kach, a militant Orthodox group founded by Rabbi Meir Kahane, and here is the insignia of Kach. Another such group is a splinter group from Kach, known as Kahane Chai, and these groups were outlawed following the Hebron massacre. A less militant group is the Orthodox settlement movement known as Gush Emunin, the community of believers. While committed to Jewish settlement of the occupied territories, Gush Emunin decries actions such as Goldstein's massacre of Muslims. However, they are committed to the idea of annexation, and that under the covenant between God and Abraham, the right of the Jewish people to Samaria and Judea is incontestable and non-negotiable. And being oriented toward the biblical revelation, I think that I would basically agree with their position that the right of the Jewish people to Samaria and Judea is incontestable and non-negotiable based upon the Abrahamic covenant. I would agree with them personally. All right, let's move to Lebanon and Hezbollah. The cycle in southern Lebanon continued in 1995. Israel versus Islamic militants, strike, counterstrike attack, counterattack. The fundamentalist group most responsible is Hezbollah. Hezbollah consistently rockets the northern Galilee targets, especially the town of Kiryat Shmona. And on the left, we have the map with the box surrounding northern Israel. And then on the right, that box is enlarged. And here is Kiryat Shmona, to the very, very north of in the territory of Israel, way up in the panhandle of northern Israel. It's tucked up right against the Lebanon hills to the left, to the west. And here is an overview of Kiryat Shmona from those Lebanon hills, and you can see what a tempting target it is. It's so easy to lob rockets or mortars into the town from the high ground. All right, let's discuss Russian immigration a little bit. Russian immigration has slowed to a fraction of its early 1990s heyday. According to an article in the November 17, 1994 issue of the Jerusalem Report, the current Russian trend is to create a prosperous, assimilated, and generally non-Zionist community. Although the Jewish immigration continues, both to Israel and America, most Russian Jews plan on staying put, and economics is the key factor. Staying means living in a society in which anti-Semitic expressions occur, but Russia's Jews seem willing to accept that. All right, let's take a look at the West Bank. In 1995, the Rabin government was planning a $276 million separation line between Israel and the West Bank. After last January's suicide bombing at the Beit Lid Junction, Rabin declared that he wanted to curb the Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists by putting up a fence to separate Israel proper from the West Bank. The new separation line is set to run along the same route as the old 1967 Green Line, although without redividing Jerusalem. The plan has been prepared and awaiting the green light from Rabin for implementation. In the words of the Jerusalem Report correspondent Leslie Susser, it sounds suspiciously like a border. The Oslo II agreement is signed in the White House. This is from the Jerusalem Report on October 19, 1995. Over a year behind schedule, after a week's round-the-clock talks, Foreign Minister Peres and PLO Chairman Arafat finally completed the Oslo II Accord on September 24th. Under the deal, signed at the White House on September 28th, Israel will pull out of all West Bank cities in the next 6 months, with the exception of Hebron, where a small army presence will remain to safeguard settlers. It will also hand civil control of 450 Palestinian towns and villages to Arafat's Palestinian Authority. Early next year, the Palestinians are to hold elections for an 82-member governing council. Within 2 months, the council's inauguration, I should say of the council's inauguration, the PLO is obligated to excise anti-Israel clauses from its covenant. Israel also agreed to the phased release of Palestinian prisoners and to Palestinian control over the West Bank holy places, with the exception of Hebron's Cave of Machpelah, Joseph's tomb in Nablus, and Rachel's tomb in Bethlehem. Now, during the signing ceremony, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin commented, "We are not retreating, we are not leaving, we are yielding, and we are doing so for the sake of peace." So the agreement effectively ends Israel's 28-year occupation of West Bank cities, though it technically leaves Israel in at least temporary control of over three-fourths of the territory. No less critically, it makes territorial compromise between Israelis and the West Bank Arabs, inevitable. So here's a map of the Oslo II agreement. Area A in the red indicates the Palestinian cities. Area B in the brown indicates Palestinian villages. And then Area C indicates Israeli settlement, military areas, and state land. So Israel is still retaining, at least temporarily, control over the vast majority of the land on the West Bank. Now, just a summary of the Oslo Accords, the interim agreement, Oslo II, whatever you want to call it. It's a comprehensive agreement on the transfer of powers and responsibilities in the West Bank and Israel to an elected Palestinian council as follows. In December 31, 1995, the IDF redeployed from the West Bank populated areas, the cities and villages in the West Bank. Now, what has been happening? I'd like us to think about what we've looked at previously and earlier sessions. What was happening to Israel? Well, this was the area originally allocated for a Jewish national home in San Remo in 1920. This whole area is Palestine. This whole area is to become the Jewish national home. However, Great Britain then divided the mandated area up during the years of 1921 to 1923, and everything to the east on the east bank of the Jordan River was now designated as Transjordan and given to the Hashemite king Abdullah, the Hashemite Arab tribe. So this now became Transjordan, known today as Jordan. Therefore, everything on the west bank of the Jordan River was now designated as Palestine. So this was to be the new Jewish home, the homeland for the Jews. Then came the Peel Partition Plan of 1937, and the Peel Partition Plan recommended that the Jewish national home be limited to the coast and the Galilee. And finally, we come to the Woodhead Commission Partition Plan of 1939, and the Woodhead Commission Partition Plan takes the Galilee away from the Jewish people. And so the Jewish national home is now limited to this tiny little strip along the coast. So what have we been viewing? What were we viewing then? We were viewing the shrinking Jewish state. It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Well, that's not what God had in mind. Now what are we viewing here in the 1990s? Well, this map shows Jewish settlements in the light-colored area and Arab land in the green area. Then, the next map shows the UN partition plan. So, as the 1947, the Arabs claimed to own all the green area. But the UN felt that a national home for the Jews had been promised, and they tried to compromise this with a national home for the, quote, Palestinian Arabs. And so this is the UN partition plan that's proposed in 1947. And you'll notice that Jewish territory has increased by quite a bit, and that the Arab-Palestinian territory has shrunk by quite a bit. All right, let's move on to our next map. The next map is the map that of the Holy Land, the map of Israel, after the War of Independence. After the 1948 1948 War of Independence, Israeli land had increased by quite a bit, and Arab-Palestinian lands had shrunk by quite a bit. And now we come to the final map, which is the Oslo Peace Accords. And notice that in the West Bank, Palestinian land is beginning to disintegrate, and Arab land and Israeli land is beginning to continue to increase. So what do we have now? What are we looking at now? We're looking now at the shrinking Palestinian state. Basically, this seems to be an example of, I will curse those that curse you, curse for cursed in kind. You tried to shrink my people's country out of existence. Well, I'm going to shrink the Arab people's country out of existence. Interesting, huh? All right, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is assassinated. Shimon Peres becomes acting Prime Minister. Now, the peace process championed by Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin generated intense opposition in Israel. Those opposing his policies condemned him for nearly 2 years prior to the assassination. For example, September 7, 1993, tens of thousands protest autonomy accords at Rabin's office. The banners read, "Wanted for Treason, Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres." October 1993, American pro-peace group Project Nisham receives death threats against Rabin. One reading, "Kill Rabin, murderer of the Jews." 1995, a rabbinic curse is placed on Rabin and calls for the angels of destruction to kill him. The curse expires in early November 1995. October 5, 1995, thousands demonstrate in Jerusalem against Oslo II with effigies of Rabin in a Nazi SS uniform. Likud leader Netanyahu addresses the crowd, which chants, "Rabin is a traitor." On Saturday evening, November 4th, 1995, there was a Peace Now rally at Tel Aviv's Kikar Malchei Yisrael, the King of Israel Square. It was packed with 100,000 well-wishers of the peace process. Yitzhak Rabin was there with Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and other Labor Party leaders. Rabin, in obvious pleasure with the size and mood of the crowd, sang a song entitled Song of Peace with a leading Israeli singer at the close of the event. He had never sung in public before, which is an indication of how good he felt. Rabin left the platform and headed toward his motorcade. As he walked down the steps of the Tel Aviv municipality building to enter his official car at 9:50 p.m., he was felled by the assailant, who fired three shots at point-blank range. His wife, Leah, was walking beside him but was not hurt. However, one of his bodyguards was also hit. His bodyguards then pushed Rabin into his car and rushed him to the nearby hospital, where he was immediately taken to surgery. Rabin was hit in the back and chest by two dum-dum bullets shot at point-blank range. At 11:15 p.m., he was pronounced dead by the doctors, who could not revive him. When it became apparent that the assailant was Jewish, this sent shockwaves through the Jewish world. And here is the Tel Aviv municipality building with the King of Israel Square in the foreground, where the peace process supporters were all gathered. And here is the area where the assassination occurred. You can see the steps which Rabin descended to get to his car. And then the area of the assassination is now a memorial. These rocks, these boulders in the memorial symbolize the earthquake that occurred when it was learned that a Jewish man had assassinated a Jewish prime minister. And here is the memorial plaque on one of the stones. It reads, "Here at this spot on November 4, 1995, Israel's prime minister and minister of defense, Yitzhak Rabin, was murdered. Peace shall be his legacy." Now, the confessed assassin was Yigal Amir, a 27-year-old law student from Bar-Ilan University. Police said that he had no criminal record and was known to be a supporter of right-wing policies. He did belong to the Jewish extremist group Eyal, the acronym for Avenging Jewish Organization, which took credit for the assassination. Nevertheless, Amir told interrogators that he acted alone and that he had received instructions from God to kill Prime Minister Rabin. Amir also said that he did not regret his deed, which he said was planned for some time. He confessed that he tried to get close to Rabin on two other occasions, but he was armed then, but failed in his attempts. He further revealed that he had planned to kill Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and said, if both Peres and Rabin had gone down the steps at the same time, I would not have hesitated to kill them both. World leaders, including Arab leaders, sent immediate condolences. Notables from 86 nations came to Israel for the funeral, with 22 presidents and 25 prime ministers in attendance. Both King Hussein of Jordan and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt attended and spoke at the funeral. Up to now, they had both refused to come to Jerusalem. On November 5, 1995, some 1 million people filed past Rabin's coffin to pay their respects. And here is the grieving family at the funeral. And looking across Rabin's coffin, we see the assembled dignitaries. Easily visible is President Clinton. And here is Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. And this is Yitzhak and Leah Rabin's grave as you would find them today. Yet others in the Arab world celebrated the assassination. Reports from Syria and Lebanon reveal that those opposed to the peace process in the Arab world fired guns, artillery, and anti-tank rockets into the air in celebration of Rabin's death. Anti-aircraft fire lit up the night sky over several parts of Beirut, which was inhabited by Muslim extremists, who immediately celebrated the news of Rabin's death. The new head of the Islamic Jihad group, Ramadan Abdullah, said of Rabin's assassination, I do not regret the death of the foremost head of terrorism in the world. What of it if the world loses one of its killer criminals? Really kind of ironic for the leader of Islamic Jihad to use that kind of language. Palestinian Liberation Organization leader Yasser Arafat did not attend the funeral after Palestinian and Israeli officials had told him that his presence in Jerusalem would provoke security problems. On November 8, 1995, Yitzhak Rabin's confessed assassin, Yigal Amir, told the judge he had made a cold-hearted decision to kill the prime minister and stop the peace process. He told the judge that he drew his ideas from halakha, the Jewish legal code. Quote, according to halakha, you can kill the enemy. My whole life I learned halakha, he said. When you kill in war, it is an act that is allowed. I did this to stop the process, the peace process, he said. We need to be cold-hearted. Did you act alone? Judge Arbel asked. It was God, Amir replied. A grieving Leah Rabin blamed those who incited right-wingers for her husband's death. At week's end, Israeli police had arrested 8 suspects in connection with the killing. Still, militants from the right appeared uncowed by the clampdown. In one incident, 2 Jerusalem yeshiva students were sentenced to 6 days in jail for trying to desecrate Rabin's grave. Both spat on it, and police said one appeared to be preparing to urinate on it. All right, Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres was chosen acting prime minister by the Israeli cabinet November 5, 1995. A few statistics on Shimon Peres. He was born in 1923 in Poland. In 1934, he immigrated to Palestine, later educated at Harvard and New York universities. In 1974 to 1977, he was defense minister under Rabin. In 1984 to 1986, he was the prime minister. In 1992 to 1995, he was the foreign minister under Rabin. In 1994, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat for efforts to end to forward Israeli-Palestinian reconciliation. Then, on November 20, 1995, U.S. News and World Report printed the following assessment: Ehud Barak, Israel's interior minister, is a former chief of staff of Israel's military. He's a Rabin protege and Israel's most decorated soldier. He's likely to be a prime player in any new Labor government. And this is an accurate assessment we shall soon see. All right, 1996, for the first Palestinian elections, Arafat elected president. And this is in accord with Oslo II. And remember, Oslo II is in a comprehensive agreement on the transfer of powers and responsibilities in the West Bank and Israel to an elected Palestinian council as follows. December 31st, 1995, the IDF redeployment from the West Bank populated areas, the cities and villages, and then January 20th, 1996, elections to the Palestinian Council. On February 25th through March 4th, 1996, Islamic militants carry out 4 suicide bombings in Israel, killing 63. March 28, 1996, Yigal Amir is sentenced to life imprisonment. So the terrorism continues in spite of the attempts to bring peace. Then Israel launches Operation Grapes of Wrath against guerrillas in South Lebanon. Israel began a 16-day air and artillery campaign against the guerrillas in South Lebanon. With the Mideast peace process at a standstill, the Israeli-Lebanon border exploded anew. Lebanon's Iran-backed Hezbollah fighters sent a series of rockets into Israeli towns. In retaliation, Israel launched deep air attacks into Lebanon, hitting Hezbollah headquarters and reaching the outskirts of Beirut for the first time in 14 years. Prime Minister Shimon Peres never clearly spelled out the objectives of the operation, and here is a representative picture of artillery involved in Operation Grapes of Wrath. However, the idea was clear: to use Israel's overwhelming military and technological superiority to apply precise and selective force in Lebanon until Syria, the dominant power, was compelled to curb the guerrillas of Hezbollah, also known as the Party of God, return to the negotiating table. But scores of deaths of the Lebanese refugees in the UN base at Qana in southern Lebanon under Israeli artillery barrage abruptly turned things upside down, and Hezbollah remains intact. On Friday, April 26, 1996, Israel, Syria, and Lebanon agreed to a written set of understandings to stop 16 days of rocketing and shelling in northern Israel and in southern Lebanon. The agreement, designed to protect civilians on both sides of the border, is unsigned, although simultaneous public announcements were made by agreement in Israel, Lebanon, and Syria. Warren Christopher was the United States Secretary of State at that time. Warren Christopher, who spent 7 days shuttling between the parties, made the announcement in Israel, standing next to Prime Minister Shimon Peres, who was in the midst of a fierce election campaign. So the Palestinian Parliament in Exile votes to revoke sections of the Charter calling for Israel's destruction. For more than 31 years, the Charter of the Palestine Liberation Organization called for Israel's destruction. On April 24, 1996, the fight was officially ended. Without debate, the Palestinian Parliament in Exile voted 504-54 to revoke parts of the Charter that call for armed struggle against Israel and the liberation of Palestine. Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres said if the PLO did not strike the anti-Israel parts of the Charter, he would postpone the opening of the final status talks negotiations in the peace process that were scheduled for May 4th. The Charter had lost much of its force when Arafat signed the Oslo Agreement at the White House in September of 1993, ending decades of virtual war between the PLO and Israel. But Israel insisted the process could not be complete until the Charter was amended. Then, on April 25, 1996, Israel's governing Labor Party dropped its historical opposition to the creation of a Palestinian state. The landmark action marked the Palestinian National Council's equally monumental vote the day before to end its longstanding goal to obliterate Israel. The decisions, while fighting continues between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, speaks volumes about the recent changes in the Middle East. A few years ago, such a dramatic Israeli-Palestinian current, peace current, would have been unthinkable, while an active battlefront existed between the Jewish state and Arab guerrillas. The Palestinian Council vote helps Peres in his campaign for Israel's national elections on May 29th, demonstrating to the Israeli public that Arafat can be trusted and the peace process can produce dividends. Peres called the vote the greatest ideological change in this century. Well, unfortunately, words are cheap. The reality is very different. If this was the reality, there would have been peace many, many years ago. Well, anyway, we move on then to negotiations open for the final stage of the Mideast peace talks. And again, here's a summary of Oslo II. The agreement finalized the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians. Talks to begin no later than the third year of the interim period, according to the DOP. The issues would be Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, final borders, security arrangements, and economic questions. Well, the right-wing Likud party under Benjamin Netanyahu narrowly defeats Peres in the election to become prime minister. After Yitzhak Rabin's assassination, and here is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, after Yitzhak Rabin's assassination, Peres moved forward as acting prime minister. In the election polls, he led Likud's Benjamin Netanyahu by a whopping 30%. Had he called for immediate re-elections, with the right still disgraced by the murder, he surely would have won. The terror attacks of late February and early March shattered public confidence in the peace process and destroyed his lead. At the onset of April's Operation Grapes of Wrath in Lebanon, Peres led Netanyahu by 11%. After the army's accidental bombardment of Kfar Kana, which left 100 Lebanese civilians dead, the lead shrank to 3.7%. By May 12th, the momentum was with Netanyahu, and by the 9th, Bibi was leading in the Jewish electorate by 4%. The TV debate between Peres and Netanyahu 2 nights before the election is now viewed as the final nail in the Peres coffin. Peres didn't want to debate Netanyahu. It was an encounter his gut instinct told him to duck. But he acceded to his aide's opinion that staying home would be a worse alternative. Tired and underprepared, he was comprehensively outperformed by a vigorous and focused opponent. So the peace talks and the pullout from Hebron then resumes. Israel and the Palestinians revived peace talks on December 16, 1996, regarding Israel's long overdue pullout from Hebron, despite tensions over Israel's decision to pump more money into West Bank settlements. All right, 1997. The modern Zionism movement is 100 years old. 1997 is considered the year of Zionism's centennial. Zionism was considered to be 100 years old, measured from the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897. As we enter the centennial year, the Jewish community was, as usual, involved in a debate. The debate, is Zionism over? Have we entered the post-Zionism era? Some said no, others said yes, others said maybe. You know, you get three Jews together, you get four opinions. Is Zionism dead? Well, you define it, you be the judge. Well, this is a good place to review earlier material that we talked about. So if you define Zionism, please define it from a biblical base. All right, let's take a look at that material we looked at earlier. First of all, way back when, we asked the question, what is Zion? Well, the meaning of the name is unknown. Perhaps it means fortress. But originally, Zion was the southeastern hill south of the city of David, in between the Kidron Valley on the east, the southeastern hill between the Kidron Valley on the east and the Tyropian Valley on the west. This originally was Zion. Now here's another map of the territory. Here's the Tyropian Valley on the west, and we have the Kidron Valley on the east. And in between the two is the lower city, or Zion, David's city. Now there's another valley that runs around Jerusalem on the south and west, known as the Valley of Hinnom. And observers have noted that these three valleys running through and around Jerusalem makes it look as though Jerusalem has been stamped with the letter Sheen. And this is the letter Sheen in the Hebrew alphabet. The left-hand stroke and the base represented by the Valley of Hinnom, the center stroke representing the Tyropian Valley, and the right-hand stroke representing the Kidron Valley. Now, what's the big deal about this? Well, the big deal about this is the word Shaddai begins with the letter Shin. Shaddai begins is means the word Almighty. It's a name for God, El Shaddai. And so Shin has become a symbol of God. It's a symbol of God. And so the symbolism here is that God has stamped his imprint on Jerusalem and the holy city. And here's another picture of the city of David. Here we have the Kidron Valley on the east and the Tyropian or Central Valley on the west. And in between is a drawing of the of Mount Zion, the city of David. That's why I chose this drawing. It shows you the town in place. And to the north is Mount Moriah. This is where Jerusalem would expand, and this is where the temple would be located. Okay, so what is Zion? Originally, the southeastern hill. Then, over time, the definition of Zion was expanded to include the Temple Mount. Later, eventually, all of Jerusalem was included in the definition of Zion. And then all of Judah. And eventually, in some areas, all the Jewish people are included under the term Zion. Now, let's make a distinction between Biblical Mount Zion and modern Mount Zion. Now, this is the Tyropian Valley running through the city. Biblical Mount Zion lies to the east of the Tyropian Valley, but modern Mount Zion lies to the west of the Tyropian Valley. Its ancient name was the Upper City. And you can easily spot modern Mount Zion today because there are churches located on the top of it. So this is modern Mount Zion in contrast to biblical Mount Zion. So what is Zion? We've answered that question. Now, what is Zionism? Well, there's a lot of opinions regarding what Zionism is. If you go to the website here, Jews Not Zionists, you'll see that Judaism, they say, is opposed to Zionism. And here's some remarks by their rabbis. Rabbi S.R. Hirsch says, "The Torah forbids us to strive for the reunion or possession of the land by any but spiritual means." And since there's a lot of secular involvement in modern Israel, the rabbi does not feel that the state of Israel is valid. Rabbi S.D. Schneerson said, "Not via our desire did we leave the land of Israel, and not via our power will we come back to the land of Israel. God alone, the Messiah alone, will bring us back to Israel." So the state of Israel is invalid. Rabbi C. Soloveitchik, "Zionists want a state in order to make Jews into heretics." So Zionism is a heresy. And finally, Rabbi V. Soloveitchik, "The Zionists have attacked the center point of Judaism, the land and the holy city." So Zionism is a heresy, according to them. And here's some pictures of ultra-Orthodox Jews protesting the state of Israel. Read in the Talmud, "Jews are forbidden to have their own state or army," they think. And then these rabbis are associated with this Free Palestine poster. What does the United Nations think of Zionism? Well, let's take a look at United Nations General Assembly Resolution 3379, passed on November 10, 1975, repealed in 1991. The resolution states, "The General Assembly, recalling its Resolution 1904, and recalling also that in its Resolution 3151G, and taking note of the Declaration of Mexico, and taking note also of Resolution 77, and taking note also of the political declaration, determines that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination." And I'm afraid, even though that was repealed, I think many United Nations General Assembly countries still feel the same way. What about anti-Semitic Christians such as Sam Rittenhouse in his book For Fear of the Jews? He writes, "During this period between the first and second coming of Jesus Christ, a satanic counterfeit, political Zionism, masquerading as the state of Israel, will be established." That's his opinion. What about the Palestinian Charter? Section 22, "Zionism is a political movement organically associated with international imperialism and antagonistic to all action for liberation and to progressive movements in the world. It is racist and fanatic in its nature, aggressive, expansionist, and colonial in its aims, and fascist in its methods." So, Zionism from the world's perspective? Well, it's a forbidden heresy, or it's racism, or it's a satanic counterfeit, or it's a vicious political movement. Well, that's the world's definition of Zionism. I would like to share with you a biblical definition of Zionism. This has been developed by Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum of Ariel Ministries. Definition: the word Zionism describes a feeling. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for their homeland. As soon as any Jew expressed the desire to go back to his land, he was expressing Zionism. And this is borne out by sections of Scripture such as Psalm 137, verses 1 through 6. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows, in the midst of it, we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. So Zion is mentioned twice in these verses. Continuing, how can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem. Now notice, Jerusalem and Zion are parallel statements here. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. So you can see the emotions, the longing of the Jewish writer to return to Zion, to return to Jerusalem. Notice the parallelism. Zion is mentioned twice at the beginning of the psalm, and Jerusalem mentioned twice toward the end of the section. So Zionism is the Jewish longing and yearning for our homeland. Nothing more and nothing less. Well, I don't have much time left. Let's just make one more comment here. Agreement initialed, pullback from Hebron is finally instituted. And let's review Oslo II again. It's a comprehensive agreement on the transfer of powers and responsibilities in the West Bank and Israel to an elected Palestinian council as follows. Election to the Palestinian council, redeployment from Hebron. All righty. Well, I'm kind of running out of time here. Let's see how far I should go. Well, I think that our next section dealing with Ehud Barak becoming the leader party head and following information is a little longer than I have time for. So let me go ahead and draw our... Well, I have a couple of minutes. Now, let me go ahead and call it quits right here, and we'll pick it up our next session with Ehud Barak becoming the Labor Party head of the government, of the Labor Party in Israel. So again, thanks so much. We always are grateful and happy that you've become our students. Thank you for joining us for this session. We hope to see you next session. Lehitraot. Lehitraot.